All right.
Last night I dreamed about a lucky time, a place I'd be again if I could find it. I'm not a fool, I know it won't be the same. Time softened edges help to deflect the blame.
Well, welcome to this week's episode of For What It's Worth. I'm your host, Blake Melnick. This is an exciting episode for me as we turn our attention to our music series, Pass the Jam, and the official passing of the jam from our current artist in residence, Douglas Cameron, to an exciting new artist. This is a two-part episode. Part one will be my interview with our new artist, and part two is the official passing of the jam, where our current artist in residence, Douglas Cameron, will join us in the conversation. We've been trying out a new approach to introducing our guests on the show. Instead of me reading their bio, we're letting our guests introduce themselves. We kind of figured that most of us cringe when somebody introduces us. Certainly in my head, I go, is this really me? We also figured most people tune out when somebody else reads another person's bio. All to say, I was interviewed on a podcast recently called Because You Need to Know, hosted by Edwin Morris, and he used the approach of having the guests introduce themselves. And I really liked it because it allows the guests to talk about the things they're really passionate about. So without further ado, please meet our new artist in residence. For What It's Worth.
Nice to meet y'all. I'm Tracy Jones. I'm a Toronto-based singer-songwriter, recording artist. I've been in the scene for many years. I started out in bands way back into the new wave days of the late 80s and early 90s. Started recording my own solo stuff coming up into the late 90s, early 2000s. Started with a co-production, an album called Picture This that I co-wrote and produced with an artist named Andrea Florian. Put out my first solo album in 2010, which was called Once Around, which was completely self-produced and mostly self-recorded. I had a couple of artists in on it with me. My new album is Lucky Time. It came out at the beginning of 2023. It's a full production album produced by Jerry Mosby. I'm sure we're going to talk lots about that, but that's the short biography history. I've been a player in the Toronto scene for many years in a combination of original music, doing session work with other independent artists, as well as playing in a couple of relatively notable, I'll call it a cover band situation. We started about 15 years ago, a project called Community Soul, where we pulled together about a dozen pro and semi-pro level musicians who had all grown up and gotten married and had kids and had careers, but really wanted to give something back. So what we did was we started a band that we donated to large charity galas so that they wouldn't have to pay for entertainment at it and all the money would go back into the charity. And we actually, over the 10 or 12 years, helped raise several million dollars for some very big charities and some very small charities. It was great. We were willing to play anywhere we needed to be helpful. I'm also currently playing in a Pink Floyd tribute show, a band called Floyd Factor. So I'm also keeping my finger on my inner Dave Gilmour and playing songs with a band like that, in addition to all of my solo stuff. And I'm continuing to write even as we speak.
Tracy, great to have you on the show. I really like your record, Lucky Time, and I'm super excited to share it with our listeners. You and I were connected through a member of the band Community Soul. I know we'll talk about them a little bit later on. Terry Donnelly, whose family is deeply entrenched in the music scene, both in Eastern and in Western Canada. And I know you guys play together a lot. And it was Terry that reached out to me and said, you know, you should have Tracy Jones on the show. He's just released a new record, and it's absolutely fantastic. So here we are. What I particularly loved about your record, Tracy, was the diversity and variety of your songs. When you sent me a copy, I shared it with my kids, who are both musicians and avid music listeners, and they have a really good sense of the emerging music scene. And I know some musicians don't like to have their music compared with that of other artists, but as the philosopher Piaget said, when we're confronted with something new, we tend to relate it to something familiar. And I think you'll like these comparables. Here's some of the responses they sent me following their first listen of your record. Really like this record. His sound was reminiscent of Bowie during the Hero years. and I heard influences of Modest Mouse and Blue Rodeo in the vocals. The band is amazing, very tight. I'm glad to have you on the show as part of our Pass the Jam series, and of course, we'll be bringing on our current artist-in-residence, Douglas Cameron, to join us in the conversation shortly. But let's begin with a little bit about you. I do this with all my guests. I want our listeners to understand where you came from, what you're all about, and who and what influenced you in your music career. So, you were born and raised in Toronto, correct?
Born and raised in Toronto. If you've seen the cover of Lucky Time, you'll see that the cover is actually a picture of me at age 4 with a little old Yamaha acoustic guitar on my lap. And I came about that honestly. My two brothers are a little bit older than me, 15 years. I was one of those happy accidents I like to refer to myself as with my parents. So both of my brothers were teenagers when I was 4 years old, and they were both in a high school band. I think it was called the Odyssey or something like that. And my brother Doug played bass and my brother Dave played guitar, 60s pop kind of band. And I grew up listening to some great music that was coming from the basement. That's what I always talk about. And I think it's ironic that I'm in my basement now talking to you guys about my music. And that's the effect that I've had on my kids as well. But when I think about the music that I was listening to when I was 4 and 5 years old, I wasn't listening to pop music. I was listening to Sam and Dave and Booker T and the MGs. And then on the other side of it, my brothers were products of this 60s generation. I was listening to the Ugly Ducklings and Blues Magoos and the Moody Blues, all of that kind of psych rock. Incense and Peppermints by the Strawberry Alarm Clock was one that I always remember. And it helped plot a course for me that, and I think there was a real turning point moment for that where I was like, I want to learn how to do this. And that was when I heard the album Beatlemania, the first Beatles album. My brothers had a copy of it. The Beatles might have broken up at that point, but I was just a kid and I was hearing this music and I thought it was really cool. And it was the beginning of something for me.
It's fascinating how we're influenced by the people around us. It was the same for me. Growing up, I was listening to music from the older brothers of friends of mine. They were playing things like Spirit and Straubs and The Who. And I was obviously too young to really appreciate the music, but it did set me on the path of my musical education. When did you start playing?
I used to sneak down to the basement when my brothers weren't home and literally just grab a guitar and try to find sounds. My first guitar lesson for real, though, I would say I was probably in grade 3, grade 4, something like that. I went to a Catholic school, and one of the things that you had to do when you went to Catholic school in Toronto was once a month you had to go to Mass, and there was a church folk group. I remember the principal, Mr. Fay, very well. He gave me my first guitar lessons. What I didn't know at the time was that I was learning these hymns, but the chord progressions of those hymns were all usually based on 1950s songs, that dum ba dum 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 ba dum ba dum 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 ba dum, right? And in a weird way, by learning these church songs, I was learning the fundamentals of rhythm. I was learning the fundamentals of chord structure. I was learning relative relationships between sounds and what made people want to sing along. A good chorus comes from a good refrain in a church hymn where everybody knows the words and everybody sings along. Now, not practicing Catholic anymore or anything, but it sure gave me an honest start going in.
And how old were you when this was all going on?
I was probably around 10. I remember the very first time I stood up in front of people and played as part of that church group thing at my school, and I had no idea what was going on. I got up there and I understood what it meant the first time to experience that freeze that you have of stage fright.
Right.
Forgot everything I had practiced and learned. And you know what? I think with some people, it makes you just want to give up and not continue with it. And with other people, it makes you want to stiffen your resolve and say, no, I can nail this. I can do this. And so I did. I took my first electric guitar lesson. I remember I was probably about 12 or 14. First song I learned was Back in the USSR. I remember that vividly. When I went to high school, I went to a private boys school, St. Mike's in Toronto. Being a boy named Tracy, who's a music guy in a school full of artists and jocks, was a challenge. But I remember in grade 11, some guys asked me if I would come and jam with them because they were getting ready for a rock night.
Right.
And it was very much the Marty McFly moment from Back to the Future. I walked in, I plugged a Fender Telecaster that's still hanging on the wall behind me into a Trainer guitar amp, turned it up to 10 and hit an A chord and blew the windows out of the music room at the school. And they were like, okay, this guy has a reason to live. We'll keep him. And you know what? I think that's where the hook was really set, though, was the power of hearing what you could do. And I actually wrote a line about this in one of my songs, three chords on a sunburst wire, like just three chords in the truth. But just the idea of taking a beautiful sunburst guitar and plugging it into an amp and turning it up and hammering. Because at the time, I was really into The Who. I loved what Pete Townshend was about as a guitar player, because he wasn't all about finesse. And it wasn't like Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page, who were so brilliant and virtuoso in their performing. He treated the guitar like it was a baseball bat, man. He just hammered on it and had so much visceral energy towards it. And that's what really attracted me to it. I think it was a real emotional outlet for me, more than a technical exercise in trying to become a fast guitar player or a flashy guitar player. It was really more about expressing my personality through that instrument and having it say things about me that I wasn't able to say out loud by myself.
Right. John Hyatt wrote a song called Perfectly Good Guitar about Pete Townshend and his abuse of the guitar. So when did you make the commitment that you wanted to be a professional musician?
That's a great question. I wonder if other people feel the same way. It just happened. It just evolved. There's a point where you decide whether something is your life or your livelihood. And I think that over the natural evolution of myself as a guitar player and the validation that I got personally from performing and playing and being an entertainer, I think it just became a natural progression that one thing led to another. And the big turning point, obviously, was in the mid 80s. I met a guy. We were sitting at the Ontario Place Forum like we used to do, waiting because we went in the morning and saved seats all day to see your favorite artist. And there was another guy sitting behind me, and he had a portable stereo, and he was listening to the first Spandau Ballet album, and he had turned the EQ so all the horns were really loud. And I thought that was really cool. And we started talking about the vision for a band, bringing groove-oriented music together with heavy guitars. And at the time, I didn't even really know that what I was describing was the first Duran album, with really great synthetic grooves, Andy Taylor being such an absolute god on guitar, rocking out. And so we started a band, and it took off. We did well and recorded a couple of 12-inch singles that got a fair amount of airplay, and one thing led to another. And you're making videos and you're on Much Music and Music Plus, and you really feel like you're on the ride at that point.
Did you get a lot of support from your family? You went to a private school, and I did too, so I know what all that entails. Was your family supportive?
That's a great question, but I'll tell you, my mom and dad were what I call Depression era parents, right? They were born in the 20s. My dad served in World War II. My mom worked at a munitions factory. So they came from very traditional values. And I think that they were conflicted about me because I wanted to do stuff that wasn't the tried and true path of get up, go to school, get a job, get a degree, get a job, get married, have kids, blah, blah, blah. But I think half of it, particularly with my mom, was she couldn't handle the affectation that came with being in a band in the 80s, right? I went from being a normal kid with shaggy long hair, and then all of a sudden I'm getting my hair buzzed on the sides, and it's three different colors, and I'm wearing eyeliner, and I'm in a band, and I've got comrades designing my wardrobe, and we're on stage, and we're doing all this stuff. It was just like another world. And I think that my parents were a little bit terrified
about
their son saying, like, this wasn't a hobby to them. They realized that this was like a big deal. When your mom turns on Much Music and there's your video, Erica M. introducing our video on Much Music, I think it started to sink in with them eventually that this wasn't just a hobby for me. And I think that, like most parents, they worried about whether it was going to be a financially viable thing, whether it was going to be. And I'll tell you, that programming set in, because there was a point where I did walk away from the idea of music being a way to make money and be a livelihood. I got a degree in radio and TV arts at Ryerson. My goal was to go into production and get into music documentaries. I really wanted to do stuff like what the Sound Source Radio Network was doing back then and all of that on CKFM. I think it's indicative of the way people are. We fall into things sometimes if we leave ourselves open to them. I fell into advertising. I was working as a gopher in the advertising department at Eaton's, and they said, hey, you've got a degree. You probably know how to read. Why don't you become a proofreader? And so I became a proofreader. And when I started proofreading copy, I realized that writing it paid $5,000 more. So I said, well, I can write copy. This is great. So I fell into a career as an advertising person. But the cool thing about that is I was involved in music as an advertising person, and it was part of my DNA. It was who I was. And it's ironic that I hadn't even thought about it until we were having this conversation right now. That's where I met Jerry Mosby, who produced my album. Oh, wow. I met him in the commercial music space. He was working for a very big music house called Harris Cole Wild back then. Ralph Cole was the founding guitar player of Lighthouse. And Doug Wild is a musical genius. And Roger Harris was the executive producer. And I always had my finger in music, but I got to do it in a way where I was also making a salary in advertising. So I continued playing. I was always playing. I was doing session work. I joined the AFFM. I started playing on a lot of sessions. I started writing a lot of the jingles that we were working on or co-writing. And my music background really fed into that.
Right. You and Douglas Cameron have that in common. I think being a musician these days does require a multi-talented or a multifaceted approach to your career if you want to continue to do what you love. So many of the people on our show have talked about this. There's a bit of a mindset issue where somewhere in the back of your mind, you've set this as your goal, you want to do this, but along the way, there are realities like making money and supporting your family and so forth. So you have to adapt and shift and do whatever you can to remain within that space around music. And all our guests have talked about that, the need to do other things, but somehow to bring that back to the music. You've mentioned some of your early influences, but I'd like to drill down a bit on that. Were the people that really inspired you, both in terms of composition, in terms of your guitar playing, who were the people you were listening to back in the early days, and who's influencing you now?
Back in the early days, when I was listening to the incredible stuff coming up from the basement that my older brothers were listening to, my earliest influences for sure would be the Beatles, and I would say the Moody Blues factor in heavily because one of my brothers listened to them constantly, and I couldn't help be impressed by the grandness of the narrative of an album like Days of Future Past, and the storytelling and the imagination. And then as I got a little older, I was always drawn to, and I wasn't able to articulate why back then, but I was always really drawn to the Stax R&B world, more so actually for me than Motown. I preferred the edginess. And again, I didn't have the language even back then to talk about what I liked about that versus what I liked about Motown. But I think when I look back on it now with what I know, just that tension between Steve Cropper and Donald Duck Dunn, a couple of dudes playing in a rhythm section with Booker T and those guys, and that edge that they put in their music and the live energy off the floor that they were getting really guided a lot of my playing as a rhythm guitar player. I've always been known for having a good right hand for the rhythm of things and a really good sense of time. And I think that was baked into me, listening to that music. And then, you know what? I don't mind admitting it. I remember a friend of mine, a kid that I was in grade school with, showed me this album by this band called Kiss. And it was Kiss Alive. And it blew my mind. Ace Frehley just blew my mind. Just the whole spectacle of it and the complete sensory experience that band represented, as juvenile as a lot of the songs are, it was powerful. And it was that feeling. And that led me naturally into who's influencing those guys. And then I started to go back and I'm like, oh, wow, The Who. Tommy was such a huge album for me when I was a kid. But it was actually the movie Tommy, because remember, that was, I think, 77. Yeah. I would have been 14 years old. Seeing that movie and seeing Elton John's version of Pinball Wizard and seeing Eric Clapton playing Eyesight to the Blind, the Sonny Boy Williamson tune, which again took me into blues. So there's just all these things. I feel like I grew up in the perfect time in music where we were still analog. We were still doing everything live without a net kind of thing, but things were getting bigger and more theatrical. And there was a lot of storytelling. And then the biggest thing of all that happened was the band Rush. Alex Lifes is a hero for so many guitar players. I don't think I need to say much about him, but I just wanted to learn everything I could that he did. And that took me from being just a rhythm player that liked to bang around on the guitar and every now and then hack out a little bit of a solo to wanting to learn all of the, as my wife Sandra calls it, the wheedly parts of all those songs. And that's where it just became an obsession with learning how to play that stuff and learning what the approaches were to that kind of music. So I would say that was all of the formative stuff that really got me into it. But it's weird because it was like this blend of heavy metal, Zeppelin, Rush, The Who, Kiss, and really funky stuff like Booker T and the MGs and all of those kind of bands. that were coming out of the Atlantic R&B scene and the Stax music scene of the 60s and 70s.
Well, it sounds like you and I grew up around the same time, and I suspect we're about the same age. And I had similar influences to yours. And it's interesting that you mention the Moody Blues, because your music does have a level of orchestration to it that's reminiscent of the Moody Blues. And I often wonder, with musicians growing up and being influenced by all of this different music around them, there must be a challenge in trying to find your sound. How much of a struggle was that for you, to find your own sound in amongst all these people that were influencing you?
You know what? I would say that was one of the hardest things, because as you're growing as a songwriter, you pick up a guitar and you play D to A to G. And you go, I can't write in that. Everybody's done that. And I questioned so many of the things that I was writing, not because I felt like I was copying somebody else, but because I felt like I wasn't doing something completely original that nobody had ever thought of. And then what I realized is the thing that's completely original that nobody ever thought of is me.
Right.
It's me and my voice and my interpretation and the way I sing those songs. And I should have known better, because I love Bob Dylan. I love listening to folk music. It is a common language. It is a songbook that we all read from. But when you bring your own interpretation to it, then you become really free. And I think that was one of the things that really held me back originally as a songwriter, was worrying that my stuff wasn't different enough. And then I realized sometimes when you write something to be different for its own sake, it's actually just not that accessible. It doesn't connect with you. I'll tell you a great story. I was on stage with Paul Reddick and the Sidemen years ago, and I was always nervous when I played with them because they're so good. And Fergus Marsh was playing bass with them at the time, who was just a monster bass player. And it came time on one of the songs to play a solo, and Paul just put his hand on my shoulder on stage. He goes, "Tell me a story, man." And that was a changing moment for me. It's amazing these things we remember, right? Especially when we're doing an interview like this. And I realized I have stories to tell. And whether those stories are instrumental or whether they're lyrical, that's valid. I have permission to tell stories. And you know what? It's up to the listener then to decide whether it connects with them or not. Because I really, truly believe that when you write a song, the minute you put it out there, you are allowing the song to not be your song anymore. You want it to become somebody else's song. That's why when I look up to Bruce Springsteen, or I look at Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits and bands like that, I remember a Mark Knopfler interview where he said, "I'll play Sultans of Swing at every show that I do, because that's not my song anymore. That's my big crowd's song, and they want to hear me play it. And I owe that to them." That's an oral tradition, us all feeling like we have a piece of it.
That's a great point. Douglas and I talked about this in our interview as well. When I hear a song, I develop an interpretation about that song, what it means to me. And when I interviewed Douglas, I gave him my interpretation of his song, Nightfall. And his response was, "Wow, I never thought about that. That's a valid interpretation you had. I didn't see that meaning in my own song." And I remember the playwright Sam Shepard used to do the same thing. People would ask him, "What's your play about?" And he'd go, "I have no idea. It's my play. I wrote it. But I really leave it up to my audience to interpret my words and to give meaning to my work." So that sort of goes to your point that when you write a song and deliver that song to an audience or put it on a record, it really is no longer just your song. It now belongs to the listener as it connects with their subconscious, their memories, etc. I think that's a great thing about music, and all art for that matter. Well, let's jump right over to the record. Lucky Time, released in 2022.
End of 22. Now,
tell me about the title.
It's funny, when you're trying to name an album, it is a bit of a process. And I had been playing with a bunch of ideas for what I thought the album might be called. But then when I wrote Lucky Time, I realized that it was the right title in my history as a person. It also reflected to me that we've been through so much in the last couple of years with COVID and with losing people, and we'll probably talk about it at some point, but there's one song on the album, the very last song on the album, is dedicated to my middle brother, Doug, who passed away suddenly. And there is so much to be down on right now, right? Like, we're wondering whether anything we hear is true anymore. We're having trouble trusting our institutions. We're having trouble trusting any legacy media. And at the same time, when you try to break yourself away from the deluge of information that we have coming at us all the time, and look in your backyard, look around you. I hate to use the cliche of count your blessings, But when you think about the people that you know, that you love, and the fortune that you have to have met my wife, Sandra, how much I love my kids, Kyle and Ryland are both amazing, now not so young men, they're in their 20s. And I'm lucky, I've got some incredible friends and I've got an incredible support network of people who I know genuinely care about me and I care about them too. And it got me to the idea that we have to focus on the lucky time. We have to focus on that part of our existence. Because, and I know there's all the cliches, you can't have the good without the bad and all of that kind of stuff. But I think that sometimes we get so fixated on negativity, and the algorithmic world that we live in now is constantly reinforcing garbage to us. It's taking all of our fears and all of our insecurities and all the things that are not us at our best and just jamming more of them at us. Our morbid curiosities, all of that. That song, Lucky Time, is on one level, it's a relationship song, but on another one, it's just about taking a step back. There's a lyric that says, look at us now here, you and me, watching the river rise from behind the trees. We know that the floodwaters are rising, but you know what? We're seeing it happen together. And if we have each other and we support each other, then we can see goodness in that.
Absolutely. And I think to a certain degree, I'd say musicians have a responsibility, but they got to chronicle the last few years of the world, just as you've articulated, how much it's changed, how much we're being influenced by external forces, how much we're trying to search for that truth, that I think it's a unique opportunity for musicians and songwriters to chronicle this period and provide a different perspective. There are also positive things, because you're right, what seems to be happening these days is a lot of negative influences. I cut off my news channel because I realized that every morning what I was doing, and I think that most people probably do too, you reach for your coffee, you reach for your phone, pops up the news, and I found myself starting every day angry. Just angry. I'd read stuff and I'd go, who would possibly write something like that? And realized it started to have a very negative influence on me. And I'm a very positive person. I turned off all my notifications so that I could actually start to feel more like myself. So I think that's a great point. So let's jump right to the album. I'm going to play a clip from the first track, and then we can have a chat about it. That was Only Love. I gotta say, I love the intro to that tune. It's amazing. The heavy drum beat that kicks in really got me going. Has that real oomph that I love. So tell me a little bit about that song.
That one was a fun one. That was actually the last song I wrote for the album. It came out of a jam. I was up north at my brother John Cook's cottage, a good buddy of mine. And he is a musician, and his son is a musician. And up at his cottage, there are mandolins everywhere and guitars everywhere and tabla drums and all kinds of stuff to play around with. And I got up one morning and just started playing that lick, that bo-doodle-doom, ba-da-ba-da-ba. And then John came down, and he grabbed another guitar, and he started playing slide. And then Adrian, his son, came down and grabbed a mandolin and started playing mandolin.
I love it.
And we played it for ages. We all were just really in a circular groove with it. It was almost a reflection, like a meditation.
Mm-hmm. I love that whole idea of a song developing from a jam session. I think that's absolutely amazing. I love to play that way. I like it when somebody just starts a song and somebody else joins in, and a jam session eventually coalesces into something more than that. And in your case, a great song.
I brought it home, and I'd had the idea originally of writing the Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young kind of song with a lot of harmony and As I evolved the song, though, and I wrote the lyrics, it pulled itself to being more personal in terms of the verses. Slow, my love, slow. It's how we've always been. It's how we know. It's the space between. It always grows slow. And so it was about being small. Again, that idea of pulling in good things toward yourself. And then when the chorus comes out, though, it's more about our universal, the universal us, right? That there's always a way to try to find love. We always need to be looking for that and trying to write those things in a way that didn't sound cliche or impersonal. So that's where that song naturally grew toward that. And when Jerry and I started working together on it, where we started was here in this basement, actually. And what we did was and this is probably segueing a bit into process, I think you wanted to talk about a bit, but we played these songs. He pushed me to play them over and over and over again, which I'd never done before. I had never really been pushed that way by a producer. And he just said, I'm going to burn these songs in, man. You got to get these so that you know them off the top of your head. Like, and we played it over and over again, and the vibe just started to evolve. And another big band that was influential to me back in the day was Simple Minds. And so I had this idea of getting that kind of Charlie Burchill guitar, that kind of dreamy guitar kind of vibe, and blending that. So there are some elements of that sort of late 80s, early 90s production vibe in it. But fundamentally, that song, like all the songs on the album, is a song that I can pick up a guitar and play.
Right.
They're not production songs in that pure sense of the word. The interesting part of the process, though, was to record all these songs as a production like this. But then I had to go back and learn my songs over again to go out and deliver them live. Right. I often jokingly say I feel like I'm a cover band in my own music, because you're always figuring out, how do I interpret this music live, which goes down to the approach that we took. We could have been a band situation. The original thing we talked about is putting four or five people together, rehearsing all the songs, and then almost recording a live off the floor kind of approach to it. But I decided that in terms of my workflow and in terms of my focus, Jerry and I got to the point where we said, okay, no, let's work together. Let's do this together. And we pulled in the people that we wanted to pull in. So everybody that plays on this album is somebody that I know quite well. And unfortunately, I know some really good musicians. And so between Jerry's skill as a bass player and a keyboard guy and myself on guitar, and I brought David Langeth in, who is a very accomplished drummer, has toured all over the world. And Tim Timlick played drums on one. Edward Pond played bass on one. And then a virtuoso guitar hero of mine, David Barrett, came in and did some atmospheric stuff on Tomorrow Never Knows.
Let's move on to the next song, We Rise, We Fall. To me, this was the anthem song of the record. Tell me about this tune.
It's a personal song. It's a song about me sharing a little bit of things that were eating away at me at the time when I was writing. The idea of when you become a person of a certain age and you've been through lots of life lessons, you wonder, why am I waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and my mind is going 24,000 miles an hour? I hear that from a lot of people that I'm friends with. I know that a lot of people go, yeah, no, it's like, I find I wake up and my mind is just flying. And that's the first verse. I woke up in a sweat of fear. If we share that with each other and we're open and vulnerable with each other about those things, that's how we make it better. And that's where that chorus came from. We rise, we fall, we make it better, afraid of falling apart together. Right. And it's interesting, when I originally wrote that song, I wrote it in G, and including the chorus. And Jerry, who again was really pushing me to help me find my voice in all of this, not just in terms of the technical singing of it, but in terms of my energy, he said, I want you to take the chorus up to C. All of a sudden, I went from very comfortably singing, I woke up in a sweat of fear, to we rise, we let, I'm belting it out. And then we added the stadium refrain, as I call it, the O-O part. But what I love so much about that song is when I go to a concert, like I'm still that kid. Like I still, when I go to a concert, I get lost in it. I took my sons and my wife, we went and saw Flaming Lips, and I was the one jumping up and down, screaming, do you realize you have the most beautiful face? Just loving that stuff. Right. And that feeling when you're at a concert and the entire crowd is singing a chorus, like really that energy, it is transcendent to me. And I wanted something on the album that felt like that. It goes with the Lucky Time thing. It goes with the idea of, let's be cathartic. Let's exhale. Let's shake this. Let's get this off of us, and let's be resilient and big. Find our grandness again. And that's what that refrain feels like for me.
That was Rise and Fall from Tracy Jones' new record, Lucky Time. We talked about this in the pre-call. I'd recently seen the Peter Gabriel show in Vancouver. And of course, as soon as he launches into the song Biko, it's a transcendent experience. I've seen him many times. He always plays the song. But when he does, everybody stands up, holds up their lighters, and starts to sing. And like you, when I go to a show, I want to immerse myself in the experience. And in my interview recently with Tom Powers, we discussed the importance of interpersonal musical entrainment between the artist and the audience. It's that feeling you get when everybody is in sync with the music and the musicians on stage, and it all becomes part of the sound experience. Gabriel's a master at it. He draws the audience in and allows the audience to take ownership over the chorus of that song.
I think that would definitely be an influence on many of us as songwriters, that feeling of a song like In Your Eyes or Biko. He was always good that way, like even in his earlier stuff, songs like On the Air, where you just want to belt those at the top of your lungs in the car. I'm still that kid, man. I'm still that kid that I turned it up way too loud in the car and people will be pulling up next to me at stoplights laughing at me because they'll see that I am on stage at Massey Hall in my car.
We all love to do that.
Yeah.
The final song I want to talk about, and then I'm going to bring Douglas Cameron into the conversation, is the song Rain. Now, this struck me as a real orphan from the rest of the tunes on the record. I love solo acoustic music, and it was a beautiful song, but I'd like to understand, why did you choose to include this song on the record?
Rain's a funny one. It's actually, I would say, it is in the top two or three favorite played songs by the listeners. I get comments about Rain all the time. Both of my sons actually have always said that they just love when I play solo acoustic stuff like that. For those who haven't heard it yet, there's no lyrics in Rain. It's an instrumental. The original recording of that, I was sitting in my dining room looking out over my backyard, and I was trying to play in open D tuning, and I was trying to match the flow of the storm that was happening, and the build and the growth and the quieting. And so I recorded this thing just with a little Tascam portable recorder and really liked it. It was a one take kind of thing that I had done. So when I was working on tracks for the album, I had said to Jerry that maybe I'll release this one as a bonus track and I'll put it on after the fact, because it is a little bit of an outlier. But as it turns out, it really isn't. The goal I had in writing the album was to not do 10 songs that all sound like subsets of each other. And one of the hardest things in recording an album is, how do you come up with a bunch of different stuff for your album that doesn't sound so different that the album has no connective tissue, but at the same time feels like you and doesn't feel like the same song over and over again? And Rain, I gave it to Jerry, and all of a sudden he came back and he said, "Now I've done something. I want to know what you think. Let it sink in." And he put that groove behind it that kicks in about halfway into the song. And at the beginning, you go, "I wasn't hearing it like that." And you're wondering if it makes sense. And then I thought, no, it's exactly what that piece needed to help give it some connective tissue to the rest of the album, but also take it away from just being my thing, me doing a finger picking exercise and giving it a groove, put everybody else in the song.
Right.
And the more I listened to it, the more I liked it. I don't like production for its own sake. I tend to be pretty deliberate about what we did on the album, and that the idea that it built with the song thematically with the idea of rain, and then it crashes down as the rain quiets down and the storm passes by. Sounds so highfalutin when you talk about it, like you probably wouldn't intellectualize it, but it really was just an exercise in feeling. Now,
here's Rain from Tracy Jones. You made that point earlier, the struggle of trying to put together a record where not all songs sound the same, while still maintaining that connective tissue. And I think you did that extraordinarily well. In fact, on my first listen, I thought, wow, there's a lot of variety here. It doesn't all sound the same. And that's part of what I really liked about the record. Okay, well, I'm going to bring Douglas Cameron into the conversation now. He's the current artist in residence and holder of the Jam for the official passing of the Jam. Douglas, over to you. This concludes part one of Lucky Time with Tracy Jones. Part of our Pass the Jam series will be back again next week with part two, where our current artist in residence, Douglas Cameron, will join us for the official passing of the Jam. For What It's Worth. Won't you come along with me down to Lucky Time? And if we take a step or fall behind, it won't matter and we won't mind. When we're there in lucky time, where we land in lucky time. I woke up to find out the calendar.